From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, possible U.S.-Iran talks on the crisis in Iraq.
We need a dialogue of some kind with the Iranians, but we also need to put them on notice. Don't use this crisis as a way to create a satellite state of Iraq controlled by Iran.
Some perspective of the state of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. Israel expands its West Bank search for three kidnapped teenagers. And a closer look at the future new president of Israel. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Sunni militants and Iraqi government forces continue their battle in the northern part of the nation. Some call the rebelling forces terrorists, but not all agree. For some perspective on the state of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, such as the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, and Nigeria's Boko Haram, VOA's Carol Castiel and Henrik Fente spoke with Catherine Zimmerman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Here's Carol.
Catherine, I'd like to get your take on the status of Al-Qaeda as you see it today. If you agree with President Obama that Al-Qaeda core or the Al-Qaeda central, as we know it, has been severely degraded and that what is of more concern are its affiliates around the world.
Obama's message that Al-Qaeda central has been degraded rings true. But the problem is that he's presenting the rest of Al-Qaeda as decentralized and weaker. The fact is, during the Arab Spring, over the course of 2011, all of these affiliates in Yemen, in Somalia, in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere developed relationships that actually extend across the Muslim-majority world. And it's these relationships that have made the network itself stronger. They are much more resilient in terms of attacks, and they share resources like expertise, building bombs, foreign fighters, money. All of this can be utilized in an attack against the United States or our interests in the region, as we've seen. And this is one of the reasons why I am very concerned about the dismissal of the threat from Al-Qaeda. It's still very strong today. And just because we've hammered it in Afghanistan and Pakistan doesn't mean that the threat has disappeared.
Well, to his credit, or to be fair to President Obama, he did say that the threat is still significant, but it requires a sort of a shift in our strategy. And he wants to partner with other countries, I guess, like in Mali, the French, in Yemen, the Yemeni security forces. What about this shift to work with our partners? Do you think that will be effective?
I'm very hesitant in saying that it will be. It's actually not a shift in strategy because we've been partnering with the Yemeni military, the African Union peacekeeping forces in Somalia, the Mali army, and other African forces in Mali. That hasn't pushed the groups back. What is new is the dedication of a budget, essentially, for this counterterrorism force. And Obama has twisted it in some degree and presented the entire strategy as being new. When you look at the efficacy of our partners, it's very mixed. And in some cases, like in Nigeria, it's been counterproductive.
Counterproductive in Nigeria?
What has happened over the past 3 years is that the terrorist group Boko Haram has actually moved from being a smaller terrorist group and simply a nuisance to an active insurgency. And the threat it poses today to the Nigerian state and its reach, Boko Haram's reach, is much greater than it was 3 years ago because of the activities pursued by the Nigerian military.
Indeed. Well, that's a very good point, which we want to pursue in a bit. But let me Henrik Fente ask a question first.
Now, let me ask you, Catherine. The president crystallized the new strategy. And of course, this strategy has been being implemented in Africa for a number of years. The United States partners with the government of Somalia, the African Union forces, as you mentioned earlier, as well as with the government of Nigeria. This begs the question, without putting boots on the ground, I'm talking about U.S. military on the ground, this kind of partnerships in the short term and then the long-term effectiveness of this kind of strategies, if you could talk about that, because in the short term, yes, there needs to be security cooperations, but in the long term also, making sure that these countries are stable, that the governance thrives in these countries is an issue.
I think that's a very fair point where a lot of our counterterrorism strategy today is looking at the short-term effect. We use drone strikes to interdict and disrupt ongoing plots, and we rely on our partners in various countries to actually try to roll back the territorial gains. But what we haven't done is undertaken a strategy that actually looks at the long term, the governance issues in many of these areas, and the grievances that actually are driving the conflict. And it's these grievances that allow al-Qaeda groups to gain popular support and actually exploit populations to their advantage. So that's where I think that this counterterrorism strategy actually falls a little bit short, where we're relying simply on military partners to produce a military defeat against a terrorist group. In many of these cases, it's not terrorism, it's an insurgency. That's an entirely different effort from the United States, and it's one that I'm not seeing.
Catherine Zimmerman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke with VOA's Carol Castiel, host of the program Press Conference USA, and Henok Fenty of the VOA Horn of Africa service. You can hear more of their conversation by going to voanews.com and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab. As international talks on Iran's nuclear program resume in Vienna, the Obama administration is reportedly ready to open direct talks with Tehran on how they might blunt the Sunni militant offensive in Iraq. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, while one U.S. lawmaker indicated a need for Washington to work with Iran, Secretary of State John Kerry said the United States is reaching out to the international community, including Iraq's neighbors.
The Wall Street Journal reports the Obama administration is preparing to open direct talks with Iran on how the two longtime foes can counter the Sunni-led insurgency in Iraq. It says such a dialogue between the two countries, which have not had diplomatic relations in more than 30 years, is expected to begin this week, even as the United States and other world powers try to reach an agreement with Iran to curb its nuclear program ahead of a July 20 deadline. Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said his country is ready to help Iraq fight the militants known as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. He also left the door open to possible cooperation with Washington. Secretary of State John Kerry told his Iraqi counterpart Saturday the United States is committed to supporting Iraq, saying it was reaching out to the international community and Iraq's regional neighbors on the need to come to Iraq's aid. Friday, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf insisted Washington is not talking to Iran about Iraq.
What we said is that all of Iraq's neighbors, including the Iranians, need to not do things to destabilize the situation even further, to not try to promote any sectarian tensions. What we're focused on is the fact that Iraq is a sovereign country, a sovereign nation. They make prudent decisions on how they will address the crisis that they're going through right now.
She could not confirm reports Iranian forces are already on the ground in Iraq. Sunday on the CBS News program Face the Nation, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham backed a dialogue with Iran.
We need to all make sure Baghdad doesn't fall. So, yes, we need a dialogue of some kind with the Iranians, but we also need to put them on notice. Don't use this crisis as a way to create a satellite state of Iraq controlled by Iran.
But Congressman Mike Rogers, appearing on the Fox News Sunday broadcast, said such a bilateral dialogue would be a mistake. He said it would be a failure of U.S. leadership if Washington does not turn to the Arab League to confront this militant threat to Iraq. The Wall Street Journal says any U.S. campaign in Iraq seen as allied with Iran and Iraq's Shia majority could risk polarizing the country further and alienating Sunni-dominated countries like Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Amin Saikal, chairman of the Center of Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University, however, sees great potential in direct talks between Washington and Tehran.
Now, with the American and the Iranian interests in the region overlap, both countries are very much opposed to extremists making grounds in a country like Iraq and, for that matter, also in Syria. Although the United States still remains very much opposed to the Assad regime in Syria, it nonetheless is equally opposed to Islamist militants really taking over Syria. And Iran has a very strong leverage in both Iraq and Syria and is in a position to help the United States in order to contain the spread of extremisms in that region.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
There is just one more month to go before the deadline for an agreement on the Iranian nuclear program. For some of the obstacles blocking progress at the negotiations, we go to VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns.
A senior State Department official says significant gaps remain between Iran and its U.S. and European counterparts in these talks, but there is broad agreement that limits on Iran's nuclear program can be agreed to before the talks' July deadline. But even with a deal, fundamental changes in relations between the United States and Iran face what the State Department official calls Washington's great concerns about Tehran's human rights abuses and acts of terrorism. Some of the Obama administration's political opponents say these talks have already strengthened Iran. Republican Senator Bob Corker.
Even if we make it through this successfully, which I hope with every cell of my body we do, They're still going to be a major state sponsor of terrorism.
American Enterprise Institute analyst Frederick Kagan says Iran's nuclear program and its participation in these talks are a means to broader ends.
Iran's strategy in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and Bahrain and Yemen and throughout the region has shown the enormous damage the Islamic Republic does when by the methods that it uses to pursue its aims. Iran does not fill vacuums. Iran creates vacuums.
American University professor Hilary Mann Leverett says remaining differences in these Geneva talks include the scale of nuclear enrichment Iran will maintain under the deal, as well as the mechanism for lifting international sanctions.
The Iranians, of course, want the United States to lift all sanctions as soon as the deal is concluded, and the U.S. side is looking at ways to keep sanctions in some way, to keep some of them, and the ones that we do, in a sense, lift, not really lift, actually suspend, and attach triggers for immediate reimposition with Iranian noncompliance.
Center for Strategic and International Studies associate Scott Modell says easing sanctions enables Iran's regional ambitions.
As it frees up money for the Iranian government, it is only going to embolden the Iran threat network even further.
Iran and the United States are both concerned about Syrian-based Sunni militants threatening the government in Iraq. Deputy U.S. Secretary of State Bill Burns is in Geneva for these nuclear talks. A senior State Department official says Burns may have discussions with Iranian officials about Iraq, but they would be completely and separately removed from nuclear negotiations. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Israel is expanding the search for three Jewish teenagers said to be abducted by Palestinian militants in the West Bank. Robert Berger has details from Jerusalem.
Israeli forces, including paratroopers and elite anti-terror units, are conducting house-to-house searches in the West Bank for three kidnapped teenagers. The three are seminary students from Jewish settlements who disappeared while hitchhiking last Thursday near the biblical town of Hebron. Most of the searches have focused on Hebron and nearby villages, but they were expanded north Monday to the area of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority. Israeli troops have arrested more than 150 Palestinians in the raids, most of them from the Islamic militant group Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
These teenagers were kidnapped, and the kidnapping was carried out by Hamas members. We know that for a fact.
He did not offer any proof, but said it is Hamas style.
Hamas is committed to the destruction of Israel and to carrying out terrorist attacks against Israeli civilians, including children.
Hamas has praised the kidnapping, but it has not taken responsibility. Netanyahu's comments are stupid, said Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri, adding that Israel is looking for an excuse to crack down on Palestinian resistance. Nevertheless, Hamas has been calling for kidnappings to win another release of Palestinian prisoners. In 2011, Israel traded 1,027 Palestinian prisoners for captive soldier Gilad Shalit, who was held for more than 5 years by Hamas in Gaza. The latest kidnapping comes just 2 weeks after Hamas and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank formed a unity government, ending a 7-year rift. Israel bitterly criticized the move, saying it would not deal with a terrorist government backed by Hamas. But Israel has continued to quietly cooperate with Western-backed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Netanyahu spoke with Mr. Abbas on the phone and said Israel expected him to help find the kidnapped teenagers. The Palestinian leader condemned the kidnapping, and Israel says his forces are helping in the search. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Reuven Rivlin is to be the successor to Israeli President Shimon Peres. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said recently he believes Mr. Rivlin will do all he can to meet the challenges of the position. To find out more about Mr. Rivlin, we spoke with Amri Sarin, Senior Advisor for Strategy at the Israel Project.
So this is actually a very interesting choice. Ruvi Rivlin is a not quite unique figure in Israel, but he's been described as close to aristocracy as Israel has. He comes from an old family, a family that actually started living in the area that's now Israel in the 19th century. And he has a distinguished political career. He's risen to the heights of the Israeli parliament, and he was a former Knesset speaker. He's a long-standing, powerful figure in Israel's center-right Likud party. But he comes from this political position because of his family's history and because of his own personal history that's relatively singular in Israel. So, you know, for all that he is characterized on issues like the West Bank as a right-winger, and that's a little misleading, for all that he's characterized that way, you know, he received the votes. Israel elects its president out of its parliament, as many parliamentary democracies do. He received votes from the former leader of the Labor Party. All four of the members of parliament in Israel that come from Arab parties voted for him. And the reason for that is because he's also been a stalwart in pushing for the integration of Arabs into Israeli political institutions, for issues that are related to economic equality. He's this really, really, really kind of not a polarizing figure and not quite a unifier, but somebody who cuts across party lines in very, very interesting ways.
He is opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state, which, of course, Obama in our country has been promoting.
It's not just President Obama in our country. It's also the vast majority of Israeli citizens in Israel. You know, polls consistently find that upwards of 75% of Israelis support a two-state solution. And, of course, it's the official position of successive Israeli administrations, including the administration, the current administration of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, the way that, Rivlin comes at this is a little bit interesting. It's not the kind of ultra-nationalist position that you'd expect. It comes from a place you'd expect as somebody who comes from a lineage and a family that has been in the region for literally hundreds of years. But we shouldn't read too much. A lot of people have been pushing on this idea that his personal views on the creation of a Palestinian state might somehow affect Israeli policy. And I think that that's just not a tenable view of things. You know, the Israeli president, as you'd expect in a parliamentary democracy, actually wields very little influence over the foreign policy of the government. He's much more kind of a figurehead in Israel. And so what people are really looking at over there is the signal that it sends that you've got somebody who's worked really, really hard for the integration of Israel's Arab citizens into Israeli institutions. And that's kind of what that's kind of how the election is being viewed, as this move toward a greater integration of Israel's Jewish citizens and its Arab citizens.
Amri Sarin, Senior Advisor for Strategy at the Israel Project here in Washington. Mr. Rivlin, who is 74, is expected to take office in July when Mr. Peres's 7-year term ends. Mr. Peres, age 90, is a Nobel Peace Prize winner who has argued strongly for peace with the Palestinians. Poverty is not just about a lack of money. Oxford University says it's also about not having enough food, education, health care, and shelter. And some poor are much worse off than others. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Oxford has released its latest multidimensional poverty index, or MPI. This year it covered 108 countries, where 78% of the world's population lives. Of those people, about 1.6 billion are listed as multidimensionally poor, and most of them are in rural areas. Dr. Sabina Alkire, director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, explains multidimensional poverty.
I mean, a person who has different things going wrong at the same time. They might not have many assets, and they might have malnutrition, and they might not have more than 5 years of schooling. So several things are going wrong in their life at the same time. That's what it means to be multidimensionally poor. It's not just one.
The MPI finds that in nearly 50 developing countries, half of the poor are so deprived they should actually be classified as destitute. The index measures overlapping deprivations, with destitute meaning an extreme lack of basic living standards. Most of those considered destitute, some 420 million, are found in countries in South Asia. And of those, India is home to 343 million of them. The MPI says there are 200 million destitute people in 24 sub-Saharan African countries. Niger has the highest percentage of its population listed as destitute, with nearly 69%. Income is the most common measure of poverty, but Al-Khair says more information is needed to tell the whole story.
It needs a measure that looks at the other aspects of people's life, like bad health, bad education, no water and sanitation, or poor housing, and sees how they're doing in those, because actually it's not the same people who are poor in both. And so both measures together give a more balanced picture of how people are living.
She says it's surprising, but in some places, many people who are malnourished may not be considered income poor.
For example, in Bhutan, according to their national poverty measure, 12% of people are income poor and 12.7% are multidimensionally poor, but only a quarter of those, 3.2%, are poor in both.
She says despite the findings of the index, policies aimed at reducing poverty are working.
We studied changes over time for 34 countries this year, housing 2.5 billion people, and 30 of those countries had significant reductions of poverty. And the really good news we find is that it's low-income countries and least developed countries that actually reduce poverty the fastest.
The Oxford study shows that the largest reduction in destitution occurred in Ethiopia, down 30 percentage points between 2000 and 2011. Large reductions were also seen in Niger, Ghana, Bolivia, Rwanda, Tanzania, Nepal, Haiti, Bangladesh, and Zambia. The UN Millennium Development Goals, which set targets regarding poverty, hunger, malnutrition, health, and other issues, expire at the end of next year. Al-Khair says the MPI could help in the creation of a replacement for the MDGs that gives a complete picture of poverty.
We need a replacement that keeps our eyes really focused on human poverty and the pain and suffering that it entails, but also brings in the environment. And our suggestion is really simple, that alongside the $1.25 a day measure or some extreme income poverty measure, that we bring into view these people who are multidimensionally poor, and that we can do so with a measure of destitution and a measure of multidimensional poverty, and maybe even a measure of vulnerability that would be more appropriate for middle and high-income countries.
She says with more poverty data available, different government agencies could better coordinate their efforts. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
Oh, sports people are so happy. And speaking of sports, the San Antonio Spurs have defeated the Miami Heat 4-1 to capture their fifth National Basketball Association championship in 16 years. 22-year-old Kawhi Leonard led the Spurs with 20 points as the Spurs took Sunday night's game 5 at 104-87 to win the best-of-seven series. Leonard's teammates excitedly mobbed him after the game as NBA Commissioner David Silver announced him as the most valuable player of the whole series. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey, reporting to you from Washington, D.C.